Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. And Eric Childress and Colin Suter, they join me every Monday to talk movies, review the new movies, and then Eric and I will also talk about the box office. That's what we do every Monday. So let's get the guys on and get to the movies. And here's Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We got some movies to talk about here, and maybe at the end, guys, we can talk a little bit about, since tomorrow is Halloween. Maybe recommend a couple of good horror movies that people can watch.
Okay.
So think about
Sounds good.
All right, cool. Well, let's start with Colin. Why don't we start with you, and let's start with Jane.
All right. Well, this is a pretty easy one to give a synopsis for. This is a documentary about Jane Goodall, and it basically follows her journey in life and how she got to be one of the most world-renowned figures in the scientific and animal science community. It depicts mostly through home movies and some new footage, her marriage, the birth of their son, and how she discovered the habits of chimps, and how she, the chimps mirror human behavior. Some might remember a long time ago, probably before I was born, I'm not really sure, but when the sight of a chimp taking a banana from a human being was, and the idea that these chimps use tools for their life and survival, stuff like that was considered, quite a tremor in the scientific community at the time. These things, stuff like that made headlines. And the movie is, very good at depicting these events and as being as important as they were. The whole movie is narrated by Jane Goodall. So this is not a documentary where everybody who knew her comes in and has something, great, glowing to say. It's directed by Brett Morgan, who also made The Kid Stays in the Picture, the Kurt Cobain documentary from a couple of years ago, Montage of Heck. So this is a guy who knows how to make a biographical documentary and not make it boring. It's not just a collection of people. It's not a collection of talking heads and static shots and all that. This is a movie that is propelled by a really exhilarating rhythm that is accompanied by the music of Philip Glass. And, your mileage may vary on something like Philip Glass. I know that it's kind of a divisive composer. You really kind of love him or hate him. But this is a movie that I think really is, really brings Goodall's life story, to life in a way that is vibrant and fun and always alive. And so, let's face it, the videos of her just kind of watching chimps for, however long she watches them, that sounds like it could be kind of boring on paper. But when you watch this movie, the movie is very much in tune with the nature around her. It's as much about that as it is about her and her life story. And so this movie it's about 90 minutes exactly. And it's a really, I think, a thrilling 90 minutes. I think this is Brett Morgan is a guy who really just knows what he's doing and really just, doesn't know how to make a boring documentary about a fascinating subject. This is a really a fascinating biography, and you will learn stuff. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You'll definitely learn stuff you never knew about this person. It's kind of weird that it took this long to make a documentary about her. I'm sure there's others out there, but like one that is, a feature length movie. that is strictly about her. And so I definitely recommend going to see this one. It's playing at the ArcLight, and it's also playing at the Wilmette.
Right.
It's kind of surprising it's not getting a bigger release.
It's but, at the, so. It's also playing at the Renaissance in Highland Park.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Oh, okay, good. All right.
So.
All right. Well, definitely recommend it.
All right. Well, there you go. That's Jane, documentary Jane, and there it is. So, all right, cool. Well, Colin, you've got a couple more here that only you saw. So
yeah.
Why don't you tell us about Thank You for Your Service.
Okay, well, this is based on a true story about three Iraq War veterans adjusting to civilian life. And Miles Teller plays one of them, and he's a new father. And Haley Bennett plays his wife, and she and the two of them have to sort of figure out what he's going to do next. Now that he's back, being an American civilian. He has a friend named Solo, played by Bayula Coeli. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But he has a baby on the way, and they find themselves, the two of them, him and Miles Teller, they find themselves spending many days at the Veterans Affairs Office dealing with endless paperwork and bureaucracy, and all they really want to do is talk to someone about what they're going through. Their friend Will, played by Joe Cole, has returned from Iraq to find that his wife has left him, taking the kids and most of the furniture. So he's coming home to an empty house. And all these guys are dealing with severe depression and suicidal thoughts and moments of uncontrollable rage. And there are glimmers of hope here and there. There's talk of a doctor in California who can help, but it's hard for any of these guys to just pack up and go. So as we've seen in other movies that tackle this subject, it's a long road to any kind of recovery for these guys. Keisha Castle Hughes from Whale, the little kid from Whale Rider. She's all grown up now. She plays Solo's wife, and Amy Schumer, of all people, has a small role as a widow trying to find out what happened to her husband. So she's in this very small dramatic role. So this is directed by Jason Hall. He is the scribe behind American Sniper. And so he's tackled this subject before, but this one feels a little more, there's a little more authenticity here, at least in terms of the execution. American Sniper felt a little superficial, but this one feels like it's really from the heart and from the gut. I mean, it's based on a book by David Finkel, and it is based on a true story. And as was American Sniper, but this one feels more like the work of a director who really knows this subject and really knows how to tackle it cinematically and to let these scenes breathe and flow in a way that Clint Eastwood, I don't think, could achieve with American Sniper. I really, really felt for these guys. And I think the casting is terrific all across the board. Even Schumer is very good in this movie, and she doesn't have a big part, so it's not like she's a distraction or anything like that. But I thought just kind of the journey of PTSD and what that does to somebody psychologically is explored really well here. And I think Teller, once again, Miles Teller, this is the second week in a row we get a movie with him in it, playing a real life character. He's very good in this film, as is the guy who plays his friend, whose name I can't pronounce, Bayula Coeli. As Solo, I think is just has some of the best, moments of the year, as far as I'm concerned, just for performances. I think the third part of the film gets a little muddled. I just you know, some of the flashback stuff, and there's a kind of a drug deal thing that goes wrong. That just it seemed to sort of veer the film off course a little bit. I'm not sure how, but I mean, it's a true story, so they got to address it. But there's something about it just kind of threw the rhythm off a little bit for me. So I think it's a solid directorial debut, though. I think, you know, Jason Hall is a good voice out there, and I'd like to see what he does next. So this is one I recommend.
I saw Miles Teller and Jason Hall both appeared on The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And Jason Hall went as far as to say that they made sure that before the movie was released, it got an okay from veterans. Like they went out of their way to show it to guys who have gone through this, and overwhelmingly it's been positive. Like this, you know, like they're the feedback that they've been getting from the people who are veterans or you know, people who have come home from war, have overwhelmingly given it a good review. So they really wanted authenticity is what they said. So
that's great. I mean, you can tell that somewhere in the making of this film is somebody who's stopping them and saying, no, this is what it's really like.
Right.
So, yeah.
And they went out of their way to do that is what they said. It was an interesting interview. So, all right, I'm glad to hear it's good. Okay, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Colin and Eric, who join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. We're going to take a break here for the news. When we come back, we got more new movies to talk about right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And it's Monday, which means also Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review the new movies, which is what we're doing right now. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
Okay, well, this is the latest film from, apologies for the name, Yorgos Lanthimos, who last directed The Lobster, and he's once again teamed up with Colin Farrell, who plays a surgeon in the film who, as the movie begins, is having a very peculiar relationship with a young man. We're not quite sure the extent of his relationship, but they are friendly with one another. He gives him gifts, takes him out to lunch, and kind of keeps the details of their relationship secret from his colleagues. And then we discover that he has a family himself. His wife, played by Nicole Kidman, he has a teenage daughter and a young son as well, and he even brings the boy home for dinner to meet the family. And details come out as we understand what the relationship actually is. And then things take a turn for the very weird as a mysterious ailment comes over his young son, and the family sort of scrambles to figure out exactly what's wrong. Is he faking? Is there something not on the medical books that they can't solve? Or what exactly is going on? And it seems to have something to do with a patient that Colin Farrell worked on and lost. And don't want to give away too much more from here. Just say that things take a real turn for the surreal. And as much as I want to dance around the plot details of this movie, if you've seen The Lobster or Dogtooth, as the director also sort of being his breakthrough film, you know that he has a very particular odd sensibility for what people go through in this world. And this is kind of a unique take on, you know, sort of good versus evil, basically. as a man has to sort of decide exactly how he's going to do battle with the devil. As a matter of fact, he, you know, whether or not he might be the one responsible for all this is going on in the first place. This is a very twisted fable, and many times very darkly comic. It's uncomfortable to sit through, but in a really good way. This would make a very good movie to see on Halloween, as a matter of fact. Colin Farrell is very good in the movie, and with his partnership with Nicole Kidman as well. If you're going to see one Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman movie this year, I would highly recommend it be this one and not The Beguiled. I forget the name of the young man in the movie. I think it's Barry Keoghan, I think is how you pronounce his last name. Mm-hmm. He is the young man who gets on the boat in Dunkirk. So if you're looking for familiarity there. It's a hard movie to describe. It's a hard movie to talk about without revealing too much. But if you're a fan of this guy's work, as I generally am, I think Dogtooth is a tad overrated, but I very much enjoyed The Lobster, and I like this one even more. Like I said, it is really twisted, very funny at times if you can find the humor in it, which I often did, leads up to a conclusion that is going to either leave you laughing very hard or have you pretty mortified. It's not a movie for everyone. But, again, if you're a fan of this guy's work, you're going to find something very interesting in it.
Okay. I didn't get a chance to see it over the weekend, man. I'm very upset.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to go, though. I will. It's playing at River East. It's playing in Evanston. It's also playing at the Landmark. And I didn't get a chance to see it this past weekend. So I'm really looking forward to it. I did really like The Lobster a lot. I thought The Lobster was great.
I'm even more glad I didn't give anything away then.
Yeah, so that's The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Colin, you didn't see that one either, did you?
No, I had every intention of seeing it today, and it just did not work out.
All right, gotcha. Okay. All right, well, Eric, why don't you go ahead and tell us about Jigsaw?
Okay. Well, believe it or not, it's been 7 years since we last had an entry into the Saw franchise. Saw the Final Chapter back in 2010 was supposed to put the lid on John Kramer and his Jigsaw persona, but here we are 7 years later with what seems to be, or at least purports to be, a reboot of the franchise. The movie takes place seemingly years after the events of the previous films. A new set of games have been concocted by someone purporting to be Jigsaw or a follower or fan of John Kramer's. Five people have been captured and forced to play a series of games where they have done something horrible in their lives and have to confess their way out of a really horrible death. We've seen these, seven of these movies. We know exactly how these things go. And while they're being forced to fight for their lives, there are people on the outside, like a pair of medical examiners who are piecing together clues left within the bodies by the killer, a pair of cops who are investigating the matter. And somehow all of these things are going to converge, as is another staple of the Saw series, that all of these timelines are eventually going to find their way into one another. Okay, so going back to 2004, when the original Saw, it kind of took Sundance a little bit by storm and was a very solid box office hit, in many ways sort of invented the quote-unquote torture porn subgenre of horror, mostly for the worse, as many the beginnings of many horror genres, usually tend to give way to their worst instincts. But the original movie also launched the career of James Wan, who has gone on to become a very prolific filmmaker, very much in you know, the art of horror, The Conjuring films, Insidious, but also did Fast and Furious, or did Furious 7, and the wonderfully little seen movie Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon. But the sequels, you know, as they went along, got very routine, got more ridiculous, more violent even, and really the only fun that anyone got out of them, for the most part, is seeing how ridiculous they tried to steer their timelines back into the original film, or at least the accompanying sequels. This film takes things even a step further for the ridiculous. And it was really troubling to think that 7 years have passed in this series. They hand the keys to the franchise over to the Spearing brothers, who have done a couple of very interesting films, including the vampire film Daybreakers with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe, and at least a very interesting science fiction movie called Predestination. And to see them given the keys of this franchise and them basically just doing another Saw sequel instead of coming up with some fresh take on the genre. I mean, for years now, I've been saying that it would just be interesting to have one movie where we just follow the creation of these crazy booby traps that Jigsaw puts together, just to see how much time and effort goes into thinking about these things. It'd be really interesting to see a documentary-like approach to a John Kramer, where he spends months putting together one of these things, because it's just amazing that anyone, especially with his illness, had the time or the patience to put together some of these traps, because even in this one, what these people go through is pretty ridiculous, although not entirely inspired, because the movie doesn't seem to have any sense of fun or horror, for that matter. The horror is just basically watching these people, you know, find their demise, but there's no real suspense or interest or fun in any of them, because all the characters are complete dumbbells, or not interesting, or just horrible people. So you don't really care about what happens to any of them. And that includes the people that are supposed to be, you know, somewhat good, the medical examiners and the cops. They're all either idiots or corrupt in some manner. So there's just nothing in this movie, you know, worth looking at. And by the time everything is revealed, you just kind of want to throw up your hands and just go, like, and swear at the screen for, you know, what they put you through, what they expect you to believe is actually happening or what actually happened at some point. And by the end, it's just the same old shtick. The reveal is not at all surprising. It can really only be like one of two suspects in the movie, and when you find out it's actually one of those two people, the ending is just completely unsurprising and pretty abrupt, actually. In fact, there's nothing fun about this movie. I think it's actually the worst of the entire Saw franchise.
Okay, hang on a second, and I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric, hang on, and Colin, hang on. When we go take a quick break here, it's Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of the latest in the Saw franchise, Jigsaw, right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower, and here till 5. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And again, it's Monday morning, which means we are in the middle of the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Every week, Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me to review all the new movies and talk box office. Before the break, Eric told you what he thought of Jigsaw. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
Yeah, so it's crap. It's absolute crap. I had the fantastic privilege of seeing it in IMAX.
Oh, you went.
It was the showtime was the only one that fit. You know what I mean? It was one of those deals where it's like, well, that showtime is when I have to see it. It just so happens I'm going to see it in IMAX. Nobody needs to see a Saw movie in IMAX. I just want to say that right now. Really, you don't need to see a Saw movie in IMAX. So, you know, like you, I was a fan of the first movie. In fact, my favorite of the series is the third one. The third one because, one, it's mostly Shawnee Smith, And two, all of the logistical flaws that were in the first one are addressed and fixed in the third one, which is one of the reasons why I like the third one so much.
I will say it's the second best in the series. I'll say that.
Yeah, I just really loved how they, because they're, like after you saw the first Saw, and which is a great, really great movie. I love Saw. I think it's terrific. After you've seen it, and then you watch it back again and go, wait a minute, what? Because there's so many things that don't make any sense. All of those things are addressed in Saw 3, which made me like the movie even more. And it was mostly, like I said, it was mostly Shawnee Smith, which makes me happy. So anyway, there's nothing to like about this movie. There's nothing new here. I mean, this is, this is a retread of a retread of a retread, not very clever. And you're right, Eric, there's not one likable person in this movie. There's not one person that you would feel that you would root for or care about. Whereas, like, Cary Elwes and the other guy in the first movie, you liked them. You were hoping that they could get out of there and at least in some interesting fashion. And, and obviously the first Saw movie was the first of its kind, and now we've had eight of them. And they've gotten progressively dumber and just gorier and with no imagination and nothing new. And, these guys who directed the movie what's their name? Spierig. Spierig.
Yeah.
Spierig Brothers. I liked the Daybreakers. I thought Undead was horrible, which is one of the first movies that they directed. And I haven't seen the sci-fi movie with Ethan Hawke. But judging by what they did here, they've got. This is a terrible movie, and they're just following the same pattern that all of these terrible Saw sequels follow. And there's nothing new about it. They try to do the big, because every Saw movie has to have a big reveal at the end, mm-hmm. There's a big surprise, big reveal, and they play that same music,
Yep.
and nothing, this is so stupid. The way that this movie ends up is so stupid. And I know it was number one at the box office, but we'll talk about this. It made significantly less than what some of the other ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really don't see this. I really hope that this puts an end to it. And it's really hard to believe it's been 7 years since the last Saw movie.
And here's another thing that bothered me about the movie. And I can't remember the logistics of every single Saw movie, but at some point, when John Kramer started this whole thing, the entire purpose of it was to make people appreciate what they had.
Exactly.
And now it's confess or die.
Right.
What?
Right. Yeah. No, that happened during the course of the series, though, Eric.
I guess. I don't remember that shift happened.
Yeah, no, it happened during the course of the series. Instead, okay. At least there was some semblance of like a good idea in the first Saw movie that carried over into the third one, I think, and that's about it. The rest of them, there are a couple of moments in a few of them that I think are cool, but I'm over it, man, and I think the audiences are over it, too. And
they are.
Oh yeah, and I know that at one time the Saw movies every year dominated the box office, but then that took over, that slot was taken over by the Paranormal Activity kind of movies.
Yep.
And now what do we got? Is it the Conjuring universe? Is that the deal now? Because the Paranormal Activity movies are pretty much over, right?
Well, yeah, but none of those movies got. Well, Annabelle, the original Annabelle, got released in October. Mm. I don't know if that was necessarily a Halloween thing, but. The Halloween thing seems to be almost like a Blumhouse type deal now. Happy Death Day obviously did fairly well.
Right.
The Conjuring movies, come out in the summer.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's true. Anyway, Jigsaw, terrible movie. And don't see it, and especially don't see it in IMAX. Unpleasant. All right. All right, Colin, tell us about Wonderstruck.
All right, well, this is the latest from Todd Haynes. And it's based on the book by Brian Selznick, who wrote the book The Adventure of Hugo Cabret, which is what the movie Hugo is based on. And this is a similar kind of story involving young people and their connections to the past. And it takes place in two time periods. One story takes place in 1977, where a boy played by Oakes Fegley, the kid from Pete's Dragon, and he's coping with the death of his mother, and he never knew his father, but he now lives with his cousins and his aunt and uncle. And one night, to make a long story short, he gets struck by lightning and now he can't hear. But he has clues to his father's past and possible whereabouts that eventually lead him on a journey to New York on his own. He basically runs away from home and goes to New York, taking what these little trinkets of clues that he has, thinking he can find him. The other story takes place in 1927, where a young girl about the same age as this kid named Rose, who is deaf, flees from her father in search of her mother, played by Julianne Moore, who is a silent film star. And her journey also takes her to New York, and that's when we start to see these two stories run parallel. Both of these kids end up at the Museum of Natural History, and we start to see other connections they have as well, as the movie kind of bounces back and forth between these two time periods. Sounds pretty basic, but you know, this is Todd Haynes, who is a very adventurous and experimental filmmaker. But what he's doing here isn't so much experimental. If you're not familiar with Brian Selznick's books, he's basically doing the book.
Right. Okay, Colin, hang on. Okay.
Okay.
All right, hang on a second. We'll get Colin's further reactions to Wonderstruck right after we take this break here. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, and we'll come back with the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday, and that means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. Our phone number and text number, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And, yeah, and you can also check out our podcasts and check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/NickDShow, and follow us on Twitter at NickDShow. Monday, meaning Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter talk about the movies, and then Eric and I are going to also talk about the box office, and we're going to chat a little bit about great horror movies since tomorrow is Halloween, so we want to suggest some horror movies for the season. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
All right, before the break, Colin, you were telling us about Wonderstruck. Please continue.
Yeah, so as I was saying, the movie takes place in two time periods, and what Haynes does with the movie is what Brian Selznick does with the book and all his books, and that's divided into two separate styles. So you have one story, it takes place in 1977, and it's told in, you know, mostly traditional narrative form, you know, color and with dialogue. And the story that takes place in 1927 is told all visually as a silent film. And if you read through Brian Selznick's books, you know, half of the book is illustrated in these really gorgeous pencil drawings. So having the movie version of Wonderstruck told in this way in black and white is really sort of honoring that aesthetic. And I think the result is a mostly very beautiful movie. I say mostly because I think this is an unusual work for Todd Haynes to do. This is a very sentimental, very kid-friendly, very, it's a movie with a happy ending where everything is sort of tied up in a nice, neat little bow. And his fans probably aren't going to take to that very well. You know, this is the guy behind I'm Not There and Far From Heaven and Carol and Safe and, you know, very sort of avant-garde and edgy films that, you know, really take risks. And this is a kind of a Spielbergian fantasy. But thematically, I think it does fit in with Haynes' work because his movies are often about outsiders trying to find their place in the world. And that's kind of what this movie is about. And I think the sort of juxtaposition of styles here is done very there's a nice fluidity to it. I think a lot of the stuff in the 1977 era is also told visually as much as possible, but it's not all like it is in the 1927 stuff. The 1927 silent film stuff wouldn't. You know, the key to that working as well as it does relies on two things. The main character, who's a young actress or a new actress named Millicent Simmons, who is a deaf actress. And she has just this wonderful face that you're just drawn to. She's very expressive and very, she just knows, you know, knows how to convey a lot of emotions all at once at times. And it's a lot to put on the shoulders of a new actress, you know, doing some really silent movie act, some great silent movie acting. And also the score. The person hired to do the score is Carter Burwell, who does all the scores for the Coen Brothers movies. And, you know, this is a guy who really knows how to find the right textures and the right feeling without being obvious and overbearing with it. So the silent movie stuff is really the strongest stuff in the film. There are times when Haynes seems a little out of his element here. There are some scenes involving the boy that I wish were, you know, could kind of be given a do-over. It just aren't as strong. The scenes just aren't as strong as they should be. There's a little, there's a few things in the exposition that need a little more clarity. But on the whole, this is a very interesting kind of departure for Haynes. It's kind of weird to say that because it seems like every movie he makes is very different from the other one, but this really does feel like a departure for him. But at the same time, he's not just phoning it in. He's not selling out. He's still taking chances with it. There's a beautiful sequence at the end that reminded me of his early film Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, which was all told with Barbie dolls. And this is there's a sequence in this movie that kind of reminded me of that. So Haynes isn't, you know, he's not settling down with this one. I can tell he's a big fan of this book and the work that Brian Selznick does. And I think anybody who reads his books, I think will get an enormous pleasure from seeing it honored in this way. So I'm recommending Wonderstruck very highly. If you can see it in the theater, I definitely recommend it. But unfortunately, it's even though it's a kid-friendly movie, it's only playing at Evanston, River East, and the Landmark Century.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's going to really have much of a release beyond this. I'm not sure what it's, you know, how well it's doing in the art houses, but I definitely recommend people seek it out. And yeah. So.
And Brian Selznick did the screenplay as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, which is probably one of the reasons why it's so faithful to his vision.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that's Wonderstruck, and Colin recommends it. All right, very, very cool. Okay, we're going to move it on now to another Julianne Moore movie. Look at that, two in one weekend. Eric, tell everybody about Suburbicon.
Yeah, and you actually get two of Julianne Moore in this
That's
one,
right.
too.
That's right, yes.
Yes. this is a Suburbicon, and is the latest directorial effort from George Clooney. The movie takes place in the 1950s in a little idyllic little corner of suburbia known as Suburbicon. As the movie opens, we discovered that a black family has moved in. There goes the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And while this seems to be, you know, what the movie, you know, might be about, it's actually just kind of a side note because the movie is mostly focused on the family of Matt Damon and Julianne Moore, his wife, and her sister, played by Julianne Moore. Their young son is woken up one night by his father, Matt Damon, and a home invasion has occurred. Two sort of in cold blood like punks have broken into their house and are demanding money. And as the situation plays out, Matt Damon's wife ends up in a coma and eventually dies. And this puts forth a series of events that is mostly seen through the eyes of their son. He discovers that maybe dad and his new stepmom are not entirely innocent, or at least at the very least have certainly taken advantage of a really unfortunate situation. Meanwhile, as the boy is trying to, you know, uncover the, you know, the harsh realities of this new existence, tensions grow within the street towards the black family. People don't want them there. They begin rioting and protesting, telling them to get out. And then, meanwhile, things start getting crazier around Matt Damon's character and his involvement of what may have happened with that home invasion.
Okay, hang on, yeah. Eric. Hang on. Okay. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about Suburbicon. Eric will give his review, and I'll give my review as well. And then we'll all talk a little bit about horror movies that you might want to see for Halloween tomorrow. And the box office is also coming up right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, join me every week. And Eric just told us about the plot for Suburbicon. Welcome back, Eric, and welcome back, Colin.
Thank you.
Hey.
All right. So continue, Eric.
Okay. The one thing we haven't mentioned, speaking of the Coen brothers, that this screenplay for Suburbicon originally started off as a script by Joel and Ethan Coen. Obviously, Clooney has worked with them many times, and they granted him access to make a movie out of this unproduced script of theirs. But Clooney and Grant Heslov, his frequent collaborator, had other things in mind for the screenplay and added this whole idea that is essentially based on Levittown, a real incident that happened there, and incorporating that into the proceedings of what is generally a just kind of a labyrinthine crime plot. And the two halves, and not even halves really, just do not mesh in the slightest. And, you know, Clooney's brand of social justice is obviously well documented, and that story alone would make for a really, you know, potentially very interesting tale, particularly in the times that we are now living. But incorporating it into what is supposed, which will normally be a kind of a, you know, the kind of crime plot, blood simple like crime plot that the Coen brothers have specialized in for, a good portion of their career. It's not even an odd mix. It's a no mix. And the thing is that the crime plot itself, the thing that you would think that would at least be interesting enough to get us through the sort of the unevenness of the movie is really not that interesting to begin with at all anyway. I mean, there's probably a reason why the Coen brothers never took this script to, to film themselves. It was probably one of those, screenplays, they put in a drawer somewhere and just figure like, oh, it's not really complete. We'll just leave it alone. But Clooney doesn't. And the first hour of this movie is really incredibly dull, not very surprising, especially, even when the film or when the crime plot really starts spinning its wheels and putting itself together. Even then, when it seems like it's heading into that dark Coen brothers territory, it's just not really that surprising, and Clooney doesn't have the directorial prowess to pull it off in the sort of the comic way that Coen brothers specialize in. The only time this movie even comes to life in the slightest is with the appearance of Oscar Isaac. And Oscar Isaac plays an insurance investigator, kind of an extreme version of Edward G. Robinson in Double Indemnity. And he shows up, and he's only in two scenes in the entire movie. And his first scene in the movie is right out of a Coen Brothers movie. It is pure Coen. Oscar Isaac knows exactly how to play this character, and it is just the only time I sprung up in my seat a bit, watching Isaac pull this character off, and you just want more of him. And you know that he's kind of short-lived for this movie, unfortunately. He's a very minor character. By the time you got through all the twists and turns and, it's kind of suffering through watching this black family who barely have a voice in the film either. You think Clooney would at least maybe give some perspective to this family rather than being portrayed as victims through the entire thing. But they don't. And by the time you get to the end of the movie, all you've basically witnessed is Clooney doing some odd Cohen-like treatise on the idea that while minorities are persecuted in this country, white people can get away with murder, which is an interesting take on society, but Clooney doesn't have the screenplay or the prowess to pull it off. This is really kind of an epic failure on his part.
Yeah, it's a total mess, man. It's a complete mess. And, you know, the idea of, you know, like the centerpiece of the movie where, you know, like a lot of the Coen brothers crime movies that you mentioned, there's betrayal, there's secrets, and that all comes tumbling down and it gets increasingly worse for the main character, you know, which is a typical thing that you see in the Coen brothers movies all the time. It just, the horrifying stuff multiplies. It gets deeper and deeper and deeper. All of that seems just like not even thought through in this movie. And it follows the same sort of procedure and steps that the Coen brothers crime movies follow, but it just doesn't seem it. There's nothing behind it. There's nothing behind it. And the vision just seems like a mess. The tone shifts wildly. You know what I mean? Sometimes within certain single scenes, someone seems to be playing it for laughs and other people seem to be not. Sometimes the humor is completely over the top. Sometimes it's meant to be, you know, dark. And that wild shift in tone just adds to how much of a mess this movie is. I could not agree with you more about Oscar Isaac. He's by far the best thing in the movie, by far. And the scene between him and Julianne Moore is fantastic. And you're right; it's the only time the movie really comes to life is when Oscar Isaac is on screen. Matt Damon, I'm not sure what he's doing. I don't think he gets a grasp of the character. You know, the motivation for what he does in the film is really confusing and, you know what I mean? And not clear at all. Like the what is the motivation for what he's doing and what he may have done? The two home invader guys seem completely characterless. You know what I mean? Like caricatures. I don't understand what was going on there. You know, there are moments of violence in the film that, you know, have, you know, the Coen brothers are known for that as well. And, you know, there are a couple of shocking moments of violence in the movie that seem to come out of nowhere. And then there's like, the relationship between, Ben Affleck, Matt Damon and Julianne Moore's, living character is really sketchy and doesn't really make a lot of sense. It just seems like this is a half-assed movie. It's like what you said, Eric. It's like Joel and Ethan Coen had this script they didn't like. They threw it in a drawer and Clooney tried to make a movie out of it and it didn't work. There's a reason why this script wasn't produced. So I agree with you. I agree with you 100% on this, except about Oscar Isaac. And I think the kid's good. I think the kid is actually really good.
Fine. Yeah.
So I like the kid a lot. And I liked Oscar Isaac a lot, but other than that, this is a complete mess, an absolute mess. And in terms of style and in terms of stone, you know, a tone and in terms of just storytelling, the acting is all over the map. There's nothing to grab on to. Even if you're watching a movie like, you know, if you're watching a movie like Blood Simple, at least there's at least one protagonist in it that you can latch on to like, even though the movie is filled with people who are doing horrible things to one another. There's at least one person or one character that you can latch onto. There's nothing in here. And I think what Clooney was trying to do was to have the African-American family fill that void. And it doesn't work because it's an afterthought. And it seemed really forced in there as well. So I think it's an absolute, absolute mess. My dad loved it, by the way.
No.
Which I thought was really weird. I just
thought your dad likes twisted stuff.
Yeah, I know. My dad thought it was great. I was like, wow, okay. So anyway, Suburbicon, a big, big, big disappointment from the Coen brothers and director director George Clooney. Okay, guys, hang on. When we come back, we'll talk a little horror movies, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, cool. Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. We'll take a quick break here, right here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time in just a little while. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And it's the Monday morning movie reviews. We finished up all of those, but we wanted to talk a little bit with Eric and Colin about some horror movies and scary stuff for Halloween. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
By the way, next week, the big one obviously is Thor Ragnarok. Then you've got The Bad Mom's Christmas. And then Okja is actually getting a theatrical release.
Locally, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. And then LBJ, which is Rob Reiner's latest movie,
mm-hmm.
with Woody Harrelson as LBJ. So those are all next week. That's what we got looking forward to next week. But the Thor is the big one, obviously. That's the main one. Everybody's looking forward to that one, I think. So, all right. Well, Colin, why don't you give us a couple of horror movie titles that you would recommend?
Okay. Well, I decided, because I think we do this every year, and every year I feel like I'm mentioning the same title. So I chose to limit my choices this year to movies that are streaming on Netflix.
Okay.
So, I mean, you can get Sleepy Hollow and Young Frankenstein and Gremlins on Netflix, and those are all, of course, highly recommended, but we'll throw a few out that are a little under the radar, a few of which that we reviewed on the show earlier this year, one of which is called The Devil's Candy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this is stars Ethan Embry as a struggling artist, and him and his family move out to this rural farmhouse, and we know that it's haunted, and of course they don't. It's that classic haunted house movie trope, and things just go pretty crazy. And one of the fun things about this movie is a sort of bond between the father and the daughter, and at one point a guitar becomes a very important plot point. This is a really entertaining, really cool little horror movie that I think we all recommend it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another one that we all recommended a couple years ago, a movie called The Babadook from Australia. And it's about a mother and a son. And the son has just this kind of, he's a little kid who's just has all kinds of little disorders and behavior problems. And they have this storybook that she reads to him at night. And eventually that book just kind of comes to life and wreaks havoc on their household. And it's one of those great horror movies that when it's over, you realize it's about so many things.
Yeah.
It's just got a really terrific ending and great performances from everybody. And it scared William Friedkin, for God's sake.
Yes, it did. So, yes, yeah. It did. I just watched it again last week, you know, for about the 50th time. It's such a great movie.
Yeah.
And it's so scary. It really is a scary movie. And yeah, the performances, both of them, the main characters, the kid and the woman who plays the lead, are great. And they are put through the paces too in
yep.
this movie, my God. So, okay, that's good.
Oh, and there's one that we reviewed earlier this year, and this is, you're definitely taking a risk with this one, and that's Raw. About a woman who is forced to, a college student at a veterinary school, who is forced to eat raw meat during this hazing ritual, and then she just kind of develops this hunger for other forms of flesh. And this is a very sort of uncomfortable, queasy little film that is very good, but you're, like I said, you're definitely taking a chance with this one.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to describe, but it's it's very enjoyable.
Okay. All right. What about you, Eric? You got a couple?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I was going to mention The Devil's Candy. I was actually going to mention the works of Sean Byrne in particular. The Devil's Candy is his most recent film, but he debuted a few years ago with a movie called The Loved Ones. Just in the simplest of terms, is basically just a prom date gone horribly, horribly wrong. It's every bit as fun as The Devil's Candy. Horrific and gross, dark comic sensibility. Short. It's only something like 70 some minutes or something, 80 minutes or something like that. So it's really quick. Available on DVD and Amazon. You can rent it there as well. Highly recommend that. I also want to put on, there's an, just released on Blu-ray for the first time this month, actually. You know, kind of a horror movie, kind of a science fiction movie, kind of an action movie, but one of my favorites from the 1980s called The Hidden.
Oh, yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Jack Shoulders, basically an Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie with a lot of gunplay.
Yeah.
And for all you Twin Peaks fans out there, if you want to see where the character of Dougie may have originated, you should watch The Hidden, because I am convinced that Kyle MacLachlan was channeling this character for Dougie 30 years later.
Right.
So that's a lot of fun. It was looking inspired, you know, Colin mentioned the stuff that's available for streaming on Netflix, and obviously that's something people are going to want to go to. Look for a movie called The Invitation.
Oh, great movie.
Yeah, that really creepy, creepy film. One of the creepiest endings you're going to see, maybe ever.
No, yeah, that's seriously the final shot of that movie is ridiculous.
Ooh, just makes your skin crawl.
Unbelievable.
Just makes your skin crawl. But also, you know, very interesting movie about grief as well. So you know, takes you know something that we've all experienced in some way, and then puts a really horrific spin on it. Best thing Karen Kusama has done, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I got. I will real quickly. And Colin, do you have any more?
Just a couple that we played at our festival. One is called Housebound, which I think, Eric, am I wrong? Was this also from Australia?
Yeah,
remembering that.
New Zealand, I think. Yeah.
Oh, New Zealand. Okay. And I it's a really terrific movie. It's got a really fun kind of sense of humor to it, and I like Netflix's synopsis of it, which is worse, being held prisoner in a haunted house or having your weirdo family in there with you? it's a really terrific movie that we played at midnight. And another one called Under the Shadow from Iran, in this Tehran woman who cares for her daughter while the husband is fighting at, you know, is at war. And evil spirits are at work in the house with the two of them. So a little bit of a kind of an Iranian Babadook is kind of how it's often been described. So, yeah, Under the Shadow and Housebound are two on Netflix that are definitely probably under most people's radar. I definitely would recommend them, though.
Okay. I would like to recommend a Jane Levy triple feature for people. The remake of Evil Dead. From 2013, which I just think is terrific, and Jane Levy is incredible in it. The Don't Breathe, which is the same director. And what was the third one? The third Jane Levy horror movie, and I can't remember what it is right now. Okay, we can go back to another one of my favorite actresses, Sarah Paxton. She is in a great movie called The Innkeepers with Pat Healy, which is a terrific slow burn, scary movie, haunted house, haunted inn, I should say, movie that I think is also great and definitely worth a look. I also want to mention, you know, getting weird again, The Eyes of My Mother, which is I just love this movie so much. And it's Colin, have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I remember I wasn't as crazy about it as you guys were. I think I watched it at the wrong time or something.
Yeah.
I don't know
if there's a right time for that movie, but it certainly had a huge effect on me. And that's a kind of an offbeat one as well. And then, of course, you know, you're just like the general classics, you know, obviously Halloween and The Exorcist and Suspiria. All of those classics, the Universal horror movies. Over the weekend, Sven Gulli showed The Brides of Dracula with Peter Cushing, and that was just a delight to watch over the weekend, stuff like that. But I'm glad you guys chose some stuff that's a little bit under the radar. So, all right.
Yeah.
All right. Colin, thanks, man.
Sure, man.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week. We got the big Thor movie next week. Eric, let's talk a little box office.
Yeah.
All right. Jigsaw, $16.2 million. That's underperformed, right?
Yeah, that's not impressive in the slightest. It may have taken the number one slot, but the original estimates had this movie over 20, and somewhere in the low 20s, and that's kind of where I was expecting it to be.
Yeah,
the last movie did like $22.5 million. None of these movies have had really good word of mouth or multiples afterwards, so they're kind of really dependent on their opening weekend to, you know, turn a profit. And the way these things are going, you know, this one's just probably not going to clear $35 million.
Hmm. What's the budget?
You know, it's a small budget film. You know, only $10 million.
Right.
But you know, once you add in all those auxiliary costs of prints, advertising, all that kind of stuff,
right?
It needs to do a lot more than that.
Right.
So don't always let a small budget fool you too much.
Right. Okay. Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Medea Christmas, $10 million. It's up to $35.5 million.
Yeah, it seems like they're better odds right now if we're getting another Madea movie than another DeSaw movie.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's great.
Yeah, isn't it?
Number three, Geostorm, $5.6 million, $23.5 million in 2 weeks. This has got to be a bomb, yeah?
Oh, yeah. It's Warner Brothers just doesn't even want to see this in the top 10, frankly, anymore. This and another movie we're going to mention in a second. These last two movies that Warner Brothers mentioned released, including this one, are just like possible like $100 million write-offs.
Man, number four, Happy Death Day, $5 million, bringing its total up to $48.3 million. That's a success.
Yeah, $4.8 million budget, even with those auxiliary costs that we mentioned. You know, $50 million gross on a movie like that is always going to turn a profit.
Right. Boy, five, Blade Runner, 2049, $3.9 million, $81 million only.
Yeah, it's nice to see that, you know, it's been a month in release and still, like, in the top five.
Yeah.
But it needs to be a lot higher than that. This is, you know, this is one of those things that, you know, you hope that Warner Brothers would look at and just like, you know, at least we made it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got our Dunkirks, our Wonder Woman, our Annabelles, our It's this year. We could take this one on the chin and, you know, maybe get a couple Oscars out of it, you know.
Yeah. Number six, a new one this week. Thank You for Your Service, $3.7 million.
Yeah, I mean, this is about where I kind of expected this movie to be, you know. And it's ironic and sad that a movie that has that title in it and no one seems interested in going to see those movies.
Yeah,
you know, unless they're actually in the war. You know, it's weird. It's like it reflects society. It's like they go to war, we support them, but when they come back, we want nothing to do with them.
Yeah. Number seven, Only the Brave, $3.4 million, $11 million in almost $12 million in 2 weeks. That's terrible.
Yeah. Just no interest. Just, you know, it seems like people thought that, you know, they had seen these types of movies before, and you know, it's not exactly open in a crowded field this month too, so it's just
right.
You know, everything was spread too thin. It never really had a chance.
Number eight, The Foreigner, Jackie Chan, $3.2 million, bringing its total up to $28.8 million. But it'll make a little bit more money overseas because
a lot more money overseas.
Yeah.
So yeah, that one's going to be fine.
And wow, Suburbicon. Man.
Yeah, this is a fascinating thing. I haven't done the full research on this yet, but I saw one report suggest, and I didn't see what they were using as the basis for their numbers, but that this is actually the worst wide release in the history of Paramount Pictures.
Is that right?
As far as an opening is concerned.
Wow.
I mean, I was doing, because I knew it was low. I mean, it's ridiculously low for a movie with that sort of talent behind it.
Right.
You know, even if, you know, it gets bad reviews, you think of George Clooney movie with Matt Damon and Julianne Moore, or at least draw a little bit of an adult crowd.
Right, right, right.
Like 7-8 million, something like that. But, you know, I had to go all the way back to Jade in 1995. Yeah, seriously. You know, be David Crusoe in Jade.
Right.
To find a movie sort of comparable to how many theaters it was released in and how well it did. And Jade was in like 2,100 theaters and still did like $4.2 million back in 1995.
Right.
Okay. So.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. $2.8 million. That is just.
Yep.
That's terrible. And then number 10 is It.
Mm-hmm.
$2.4 million. It's up to $323.7 million total.
Yeah, $656 million worldwide.
Man, amazing. All right. So, what do you think Thor is going to make? What are we looking at here?
Well, I mean, the Dark World pulled in $85 million on opening weekend. I'm thinking this one does something comparable to that, maybe a little bit higher. I'm thinking somewhere between, like, 88 and 92, something
okay.
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be the only game in town next week. I think the addition of Hulk, you know, makes it a little bit more of it's a little closer to an Avengers movie than a Thor movie.
Right.
You know, and, you know, Thor movies have done fine. They just they haven't quite done the same numbers that some of the other Marvel movies have done. But I think this one, you know, there seems to be a lot more going on in it. The Hulk connection to it. So I think that this one's going to do a little bit better, though I don't think it's going to do as well as Justice League does when that comes out.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what we're looking forward to. And I think I have high hopes for Thor. I think I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, Taika Waititi.
Yeah. So. There it is. That's it. Okay, man. Well, thanks a lot. And we will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right. There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. He joins me and Colin Suter every Monday morning for the movie reviews. And we talk box office, which we did and we will do again next week.